Support for Longform this week comes from listening. If you've ever had to rip through a huge pile of academic papers, you know how painful it can be to spend all that time staring at a piece of paper. Listening makes it really simple to convert anything you have to read into spoken words that you can enjoy on the go. Uses AI to generate realistic voices that sound like actual human beings. Plus, it comes with a powerful set of tools that allows you to do stuff like skip over non-essential text, but also take notes with one click. Your life just got a lot easier. Normally, you'd get a 2-week free trial, but listeners of Longform get a whole month free. Go to listening.com/longform or use code Longform at checkout.
Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hello.
Hey, greetings, Max.
I'll tell you who I had on the show this week. No problem. This week on the show, I talked to Lindsay Peoples. She is the editor-in-chief of The Cut. Before that, she was the editor-in-chief of Teen Vogue. I feel like it is notable that she was the youngest editor-in-chief in the history of Condé Nast. She got that job when she was in her 20s. Before she was at Teen Vogue, she was at The Cut as a fashion editor. She wrote an article you guys might remember. It was called Everywhere and Nowhere, and it was about what it is like to be Black in fashion. It caused a tremendous, tremendous reaction in that world. And we talked about journalism and fashion, the relationship between those two things. We talked a lot about what it means to run a magazine in 2024. We talked about what a magazine is in 2024. And also talked about all kinds of other interesting things. She was fantastic to talk to. I really enjoyed this one. I should also say there's a couple times in the interview where Lindsay and I are talking about someone named David, but we don't say who that is or what his last name is. It's David Haskell. That's the editor-in-chief of New York Magazine.
Did you discuss how The Cut is responsible for like every viral story of the last 3 years?
At some length, yes.
Hey, I'm going to listen to this one.
Yeah. Wow. The real stamp of approval. Aaron's going to listen.
What an endorsement.
You're welcome, Max. You're welcome.
We are brought to you in partnership with Vox. As always, we thank them.
Here's Max with Lindsay Peoples.
Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on the podcast. This is such a thrill to talk to you.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
I have so many questions. A lot of them are about something that seems to be happening with The Cut right now, although I'm sure you're going to tell me it's been happening for a long time. But
it has, yeah.
I do need to understand how you all keep doing this. But to start, I was hoping that we could go back and you could tell me a little bit about growing up in Brown Deer, Wisconsin.
Correct.
When did the path that has taken you to being the editor-in-chief of The Cut, when did that start in your mind?
Honestly, I think it just was little things over time, right? Like I didn't have a big moment where I was like, this is going to happen or this is what I want. It's always been more so about just the general direction of life that I really cared about and just wanting to really do something that I was passionate about and just felt purposeful. I was at a dinner the other night and a woman asked me, she was like, if you weren't doing this, what would you do? And I was like, I'd be doing this. And it's really nice to feel that way. But I do think, you know, when I was growing up, I just really liked everything that was creative and artistic. There wasn't really a blueprint for that. It felt very far. It just felt like a hobby, like something fun that I wanted to do. I would spend my summers just knitting and crocheting with my grandmother. And then she would bring all these different magazines and some we would make, you know, take some of the patterns and make stuff. Or I would just flip through them while they were all talking in a circle. And I just spent a lot of time hearing their conversations and what they wanted to talk about. And then what was on TV, the morning TV shows with them. And it's very like slow living in the Midwest, but it gives you the time to actually comprehend a lot of conversations. And so honestly, when I went to college, I just really liked the hills. And I remember telling a professor, like I remember telling her, you know, this just seems really cool. And this is kind of what I'm doing and thinking about ideas and what I've been trying to do. And I don't know if that's really a job, but it seems like it is. I just very specifically was like, this experience at Teen Vogue seems amazing. Like I would want to try that. And I just didn't think that I would get the opportunity. So she actually put in my application for an internship at Teen Vogue and I got it. And so I just was hooked from the beginning, and it was never about a title. I would say that it was about specific publications that I was really drawn to. I still have all of my old Teen Vogues. Like, I collected Lucky, I collected Glamour, and I remember just loving the cut and feeling like it was so funny and important. And so I didn't have the specific dream or goal or even think it was possible for me to be an editor-in-chief, but I always just had the hunger for storytelling.
I got to go back in the story you just told for a second. So you were watching The Hills.
Yeah. Lauren Conrad. A good time.
You saw Lauren Conrad. That's exactly where I thought this story was going to go. You saw Lauren Conrad interning at Teen Vogue and you were like, I want to do that. And then you told the professor, and then the professor applied on your behalf. Did you know that your professor was doing that?
No.
So how did you find out you got the internship?
She was the one who put my email in, and then I got the notification. And I remember I went to her office and I was like, wait, what? And this was when people may remember Ed2010 was a website, and people found jobs on Ed2010 and different internships. And so I just went in completely green. I had no idea what I was doing, and I had to just do grunt work, but I loved it.
Man, that professor must have really seen something in you.
Yeah, I mean, they were all very wonderful. I mean, everybody's just nice in the Midwest. So I just took it as, you know, she just saw something in me, but also just wanted me to not shoot myself down before I even tried.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And when you got there, when you got to Teen Vogue, how did the experience of actually being there line up with whatever your assumptions had been?
Honestly, I didn't care that it wasn't glamorous or that I just was running around or merchandising 600 pairs of Converse by size and color. I didn't care that it wasn't, you know, the perfect thing. I just was happy to be there, to be honest with you. And I really wanted to learn. Like, I couldn't even comprehend, like, how do we turn all of these amazing things into stories and a whole issue? And I would just sit there and stare at the lineup and watch people all day and just do whatever they told me. So it didn't matter to me.
I've heard you talk a little bit about how much you had to do on the side to make ends meet in that time.
Yeah.
What did that teach you? Like, what impact did that have on the way that you work now? You were waiting tables and working second jobs. How does that impact how you operate in this job now?
I think that it just, even when I get a no, it doesn't deter me. Or if something seems really daunting to other people, it usually doesn't feel it to me. I'm completely aware that my risk tolerance is much higher than other people. So I often go into a meeting, I'm like, I'm just flagging, this is probably going to be a little annoying, probably overambitious, but here's the idea. But I think it's also just constantly made me feel like there was always something that I thought, man, I'm not going to get through this. Like, I remember being here in New York and feeling like I'm always going to be stuck waiting tables on the weekends, doing all these freelance shoots, not really making enough money, but this being my dream. And I got through that. And at every point, I've gotten through every really hard thing that I convinced myself I couldn't. So even now, when it feels like we're climbing up the mountain to try to make something bigger or better or perfect something that we're working on, it's just more so of a reminder that, you know, it's all been hustle.
And does that, like, compound? The more times that you stick it out and get through something, does it make it easier to do it the next time?
I think just you carry it differently, right? Like, I don't think it's ever easy. Like, this job has not gotten easier, but I do think that I carry it a lot lighter now.
What does that look like? How does that manifest?
I honestly think it manifests in a way where when people are reading the cut, I think you can tell that we're having fun. We really do enjoy it. And obviously I'm biased because I love it. I love this brand and I loved it when I worked here before and I love it again. But I think you can tell when people love what they're doing and when they're excited and they're actually care. This really is important to me, just on, yes, intellectually, but emotionally. Like, it really is something that we're invested in. So I think that's where it's manifested, where it feels like it's not as nearly as hard anymore, but it definitely feels lighter that, you know, you just build up a confidence, honestly.
What was your confidence like in the fashion world when you first came to New York? Like, what was it like to step into that world? And I should say, it's a world I know nothing about. So it's hard for me to even imagine what that was like.
Have you watched The Devil Wears Prada?
No.
Okay. Well, I was going to say that's pretty. It's
that would have been the research I should have done.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think when I first moved here, it definitely was a culture shock. It was a struggle for me because I think that was my first time really understanding up close and personal what it means for people to have wealth and make you feel bad that you don't have that. I think it also was the first time that I experienced very just disparaging kinds of racism. I was used to a certain level of consistent racism that I had just, this is what I can accept, this is what I can live with. But it really turned up when I moved here and started working in fashion. And I think, honestly, I just remember crying a lot during that time, but more so because I think that it all felt so raw. And especially most of the tension I felt like came from the fact that there was a lot of things that would occur that I wanted to correct or that I wanted to speak up on. But I also needed a job to be able to live here and work here. And I also felt like as a Black person in the industry that I needed to be part of certain infrastructures to make changes. There's only certain changes that can actually happen outside of the system of fashion. Most of it has to happen within the system. And so there was constantly this pressure that, you know, I don't want to sell out. I don't want to be the person that feels like they have to be palatable for white people to understand the kind of work that they're doing. But I also need to be part of this and be able to engage in this in a way that's sustainable for me so I don't burn out.
Did that balance feel like a compromise?
I mean, I think at the time, maybe, but I think I don't think that I've, you know, ever achieved balance in it. I think it's, I've achieved some kind of levity in sticking to who I am and what I really want to do, but also being part of the industry in a way that just allows me to show up and continue to talk about a lot of the amazing things that we're doing at The Cut. But it is a fine line, 100%.
And did you feel back then or now, I guess, like you were navigating that fine line or trying to find it on your own?
I felt like I had to try to find it on my own. I remember having this conversation with a lot of people and I didn't really ever fit in either bucket. And it felt like, you know, there was always a struggle for me to, I remember there was just a specific time where I was like, I need Black mentors. I need, like, I want to work at a Black publication and all of that. And it just never came to fruition. It just never happened for many different reasons, nothing specific. But I remember just feeling like I need that guidance or else I'm not going to get to where I want to be. And then it also, on the other side, came where I would talk to a lot of people in the industry who weren't people of color. And there was a hesitancy to trust me, to trust my work, to trust my work ethic, but also wanting to change me and mold me into something that I'm not. And so I very early on, I think more so just spent a lot of time making agreements with myself and my own integrity and who my parents raised me to be of what kind of editor I want to do. And I think also, I mean, I talk about the having jobs and all that because I do think it's important to be transparent about that with so many people of color when they, you know, DM me or come up to me at a talk or something and they say, I really want to be in fashion. I talk about it because I want them to understand the reality of the experience and that it's not just like, oh, you're having fun in the closet on Instagram. Definitely not. But also that I felt like there were times where I had to make a choice of either I'm in or I'm out, or either I'm going to put my feet to the fire on this or I'm not. And that's just the nature of being a Black woman and an editor.
Were you ever close to choosing to be out?
Of course. Yeah. But I also felt like it helped me because I always felt like I didn't hold it too tight. And I felt like if I have to change who I am or feel like I'm not making the work that I really want to make, then I can go back and be a waitress. I was also mm-hmm. very good waitress, so.
This might be hard to articulate, but what is making agreements with yourself look like?
Specifically, honestly, there were just a lot of times where I would see other Black people in the industry allow certain behaviors or allow people to talk to them a certain way. And there were agreements that I made with myself of, I want to be in this industry, but I don't want it bad enough to ever have to compromise who I am. I don't ever want it bad enough where I feel like I'm performing for people and I'm trying to be somebody for them that I'm really not. And so, you know, I think that I also just came in fashion at a really particular time because there were a lot of Black people in the industry, but there was a lot of hesitancy to actually have real conversations about race. When I wrote Everywhere and Nowhere, I think it was 2018.
It was August 2018. And,
yeah.
And the piece you're referring to is, it's called Everywhere and Nowhere, What It's Really Like to Be Black and Work in Fashion. And it was almost like an oral history. And you talk to people from all over the industry, not just in media, but stylists, photographers, models.
Yeah.
Was there a moment that prompted you to do that piece? And my sense is that it took months and months of reporting to do. I mean, it was a huge lift.
It did, but it was actually an idea. I had pitched it first 4-5 months of being at The Cut. So it was an idea that I had for a really long time. And honestly, when I pitched it, there just weren't enough Black people in senior leadership to make the drop of, okay, so here's what it's like when you're a senior level person versus this.
We should say that at the time you were a fashion editor at The Cut.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I was a fashion editor at that time. And when I pitched the idea, it just wasn't enough. There weren't enough Black people across the industry in senior level roles. And it mainly the pre-reporting that I had done was all assistants, mm-hmm. which had already been done, but also it just felt very repetitive. And obviously nobody loves being an assistant. So then it didn't just have as much validity and punch when you need a very senior level person. You need this big makeup artist. You need this big stylist. Like you need all of those things to actually say these people are really seemingly successful, but they're actually struggling. And we just didn't have that tension when I first pitched it. So it was just something that I'd worked on, honestly, for a really long time. And then, yes, committed to, you know, being this bigger piece months in advance. But even when I wrote that, I remember being very terrified, but very sure that this was the kind of work that I needed to do. I've always been attracted to, if I was scared of it, I just wanted to do it just to not be afraid anymore. And I talked to a lot of Black people in the industry who I respect and adore, but who told me, you know, you shouldn't do this and it's a bad idea. And
why exactly? What was the fear?
The fear is always that, you know, you won't be booked for another gig or you won't be thought for, you know, this opportunity, or you won't be considered when, you know, most of these jobs also are never really listed because so much of fashion is subjective, right? So if they like you, if they like how you look, I mean, that was part of the stress of me even working in fashion. So much of it is, you know, I remember starting out at Teen Vogue and I was like, I have to run across the street to Gap because this is when Condé was in Times Square and I had to get a shirt with my skirt and I'd saved all my money to buy this Miu Miu skirt because I knew I needed something designer on. And, you know, to be able to, you use that as kind of like a social currency when you work at a magazine, especially a fashion magazine, to be able to have them, you know, create a conversation around, oh, I like your skirt, or where did you get that? Or I remember that pattern, because I didn't have any other talking points. They didn't know who I was. There was a million girls there and I was always the first one in and the last one to leave, but you need all those kinds of things. And so I think so many Black people felt like you make all of these efforts to try to get someone to pay attention to you and just give you a chance, right? Why would we then speak up about and complain about all the things that are wrong when we've worked so hard to try to get our foot in the door? You know, and I agreed with that then and I agree with it now, but I think it was more so that when we have a seat at the table, we can't just sit here. We can't just say, okay, I have this seat. I'm grateful. I'm going to chill. And I really felt like I was supposed to be an editor in some sense to just move things forward. And so I just did it scared anyway.
Was it hard to convince people to talk to you for it? There's a fair number of like anonymous quotes in there, but the breadth of people you talked to was so huge. And I wondered about what the reporting process was like and whether it was tough to get people to go on the record for that same reason you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, it's always tough to get people to go on the record and be really honest about something that could cost them their next opportunity. Right. So I understood that and wanted to give anonymity to people that felt like they needed it. But I think also what I just pressed with them about was that if we don't do this now, when is the right time? Like there really was no proper time for us to speak up about it. And I think that it invigorated something in some of the people who were older than me and had been, you know, dealing with a lot, because most of the calls, honestly, were just people crying. And they just needed an outlet to be able to say, like, all of these things had happened. And I think there was always something interesting to me, because people would look at, I would look at these people and say, this must be amazing. Like, they've climbed to the top of this mountain. This looks incredible. This is something a Black person has never done. But the reality of their experience was that they were just in fear all the time and constantly having to cater to other people's needs and not having the space to speak up or show up fully as themselves. And so I think that a lot of them actually felt a sense of freedom afterwards.
Did you?
I did, but I knew something was going to be different. I just remember feeling like my life is never going to be the same after this. I remember just being like, I love the cut. I don't know if I'm going to stay or leave, but I know I just can't stay in this role. Like, I want to do things that are bigger, and I feel like I need some room to breathe. That's all I remember.
Before it came out, you remember feeling that way? Like, doing this project gave you some sense that there was more space that you wanted to fill?
Yeah, for sure. And then after, I mean, the day of, I didn't even look. I actually left the country. I went to Mexico and I turned my phone off. And the next day, when I turned my phone on, people were calling me, and I knew that everyone had read it. But I just was really proud in that moment. I remember thinking, even if other people don't like this, or even if it goes the other way, like, this is the work that I had to do. And even if this means I don't get another job, or I have to stay in this job and try to figure out what I want to do next, I had no regrets.
And did you have an idea when you were sitting on a beach in Mexico of what that space you wanted to grow into was going to be?
No idea.
No idea. You just knew there was something.
Zero idea. I just remember feeling like, I've outgrown this now. That's all I remember. I looked at the journal the other day, and I literally, that's what I wrote down. I have no idea what I'm going to do next, but I've outgrown this.
Support for Longform this week comes from Listening. If you find yourself behind the eight ball, needing to read a bunch of academic papers or journals or any kind of dense reading material, you might make your life a lot easier by checking out Listening. It takes anything, articles, books, PDFs, and turns the text into spoken word that you can absorb no matter what you're doing. The app has lifelike AI voices complete with emotion and intonation that creates a realistic and pleasant listening experience. So I had to go into the city for some meetings. I needed to review some PDFs, threw them in there, listened to them on the way. It was both pleasant, and I kind of forgot that I wasn't like listening to a professionally done audiobook or something. Like, very quickly, the voices sounded totally natural and human to me. This listening app might just transform how you consume reading material, and you can give it a shot yourself risk-free. Now, normally you'd get a 2-week free trial, but listeners of Longform get a whole month free. Go to listening.com/longform or use the code longform at checkout. Listening. Your life just got a lot easier.
Well, to get back to you in Mexico, it did seem like the next move came pretty quickly. You got named editor-in-chief of Teen Vogue in October, which was, you know, a month after that piece came out. You were the youngest EIC in the company's history, one of the only Black journalists in a leadership role at Condé. What was that job like? What was it like taking over Teen Vogue?
Honestly, I had such a incredible time, and it's still crazy when people say it back to me. It's wild, because I really did just watch The Hills, and I was like, I want to do this, right? And I think it was just a really surreal full circle moment. And I've been incredibly fortunate in that way, because to see it from when I was interning to assisting and coming back, I just had so much rich history and I think also perspective on things that I'd seen that I really liked and some things that I really didn't want to do anymore. And I think, I mean, it was one of the best surprises of my life for sure. I didn't expect it at all, but I also fully felt like this is going to be different because I've always been very unapologetic in my Blackness and in my stance on a lot of things. And so I knew that I wasn't going to just do traditional EIC dance. And I knew that I really wanted to make a lot of changes, but also make sure that people felt supported and like the brand was thriving and just bring like a sense of excitement back. And so mm-hmm. there was a lot of different things at one time, but I always just think of how crazy it was at the same time that I came back.
It's pretty wild.
So, yeah.
How did you choose where to focus? Because I imagine like you come into a job like that and it's like, there's a thousand things you could do every day. There's tons of different choices and priorities that you could focus on. How did you pick what was going to have the biggest impact?
Very immediately, it was, what are the things from the past that we want to keep? And what are the things that we're going to leave behind? I think a lot of times when you start out as an EIC, like you inherit this team and it's a new brand and there's this rich history and there's all these things that you've always done. I had to really quickly just be decisive about and just have a sense of discernment on what are the things that we want to keep from the past that we've done really well or we want to kind of update and change, and what are things that we just want to leave there and stop picking them up and pick up something new.
And did those calls come easily to you?
Yeah, they did, but actually bringing them to life did not come easy. No. So I pretty much, because I had been at the brand for so many times, it did feel like, oh, okay, you know, I don't really want to cover debutante balls anymore because that doesn't feel like us anymore. And that may have rung true 10 years ago, but now that feels tone deaf. But how do we now then talk about class? And how do we now talk about things that we've done before, but in a different way? So I had a pretty clear idea from the start, but actually then forming a vision around that obviously just takes time as you build a team and editorial strategy and all those things.
Were you patient?
I actually was. I do feel like I'm quite patient on that side of things, but I do think the internet runs so fast that my mind will then be going like, well, how long is it going to take? Because I do feel like we need to meet this moment by a certain time for people to care about the fact that we made this change.
Did the project of that change, did it feel like you were ready for that? Like you had been building to that? Or did it feel like it was on a different planet? Do you know what I mean? Like, did it feel like a continuation of the work you'd been doing? Or was it something totally new?
No, I honestly, it felt, it was obviously new, right? Like I think I was 26, maybe.
It's
wild. So it was, of course, something new and managing a whole team. And I remember also realizing I don't really have as much privacy anymore in this kind of role. Like there were definitely a shift in a lot of different things, but at the same time, I felt really equipped, even if I didn't have the exact idea of I've done this before, so I know how to do it. I felt like I had the tools in my toolbox to be able to pull it off. And I also was just really genuinely excited about the job and not caught up in the title, which I think people can tend to be really caught up in if you get the certain title and how it looks and all of that. But I was genuinely excited to sit on the ground and stare at old Teen Vogue's for a night. And so,
yeah, in a day-to-day way, what was energizing about that job? I think people listening might not totally understand what being editor-in-chief entails.
I mean, that job, the day-to-day was really that, you know, there was a lot of decisions being made for the brand as far as, okay, are we going to still do the Teen Vogue Summit? Or are we doing Young Hollywood? Are we doing all of these things that we've traditionally done at the brand? How are we going to make them feel fresh and innovative for an audience? And then this was probably also maybe a year or two before the pandemic. And so we had started to talk about all these events and then very quickly had to shift to, we're not doing these events in person. Yeah. How do we now then do prom virtually? How do we actually make that a moment and fun for people at home? How do we sustain this business financially? And I feel like my role has always been very much half creative, half business, both, you know, currently at The Cut and formerly at Teen Vogue, because it's not just about the ideas and who we put on the cover and all of that, but also the health of this business and how we're able to grow. And so the days were always, yes, I think I've spent the last 10 years in meetings every day, but it was also, yeah, spreading the gospel of what is Teen Vogue now? How are we doing things? How are we having these conversations in a way that people haven't seen us in the past? And so you saw that in a lot of our politics coverage of people thinking like Teen Vogue is too young of a brand to be able to pull this off. And we prove people wrong time and time again, that young people's voices do matter in elections and do matter in politics. And that there isn't shame in asking questions or not understanding why this works in a certain way. And so I do think that it just took time to build, for sure.
Well, you were only in the job for like 3 years.
And
then you left for this one. Was that enough time to do what you wanted to do? And what made you want to come and lead the cut?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was enough time. I think that I wanted to do so many things. I loved that team. I still do. I think that they're doing incredible work to this day. And so, but I didn't want to overstay my welcome. And I also wanted to do a different kinds of work that I felt like, you know, yes, I could do this at Teen Vogue, but I need a bigger audience to be able to create it, because it was a little bit siloed of obviously being geared towards teen and younger audience. And I got older and I was like, there are some things that I personally want to talk about that may not be a fit for Teen Vogue, because that's just really not the target audience. And so it just was a natural, honestly, evolution, but I didn't know about the cut job opening. And so when David emailed me, I was really surprised.
Obviously, when you get an email like that, you're going to think about it. But that thing you're describing, it sounds a little similar to me to the feeling that you were describing in Mexico, where you were like, something new needs to happen. How much of that is like intellectual? Like how much of that is going on in your head, and how much of that is a feeling? Like how much of that is in your heart?
Oh, it's all in my heart. I think that if I were thinking about it, I would stay where in the most comfortable scenario, but it's definitely an emotional thing where I feel it, of that just, I don't know. I think it reminds me of a lot of conversations with my grandmother when I started to talk to her about fashion. She was the only person that I really told. And it wasn't like I couldn't tell my parents, because I'm very close with my family. But I think there was just a safety for me to explore with her and just say things that I was scared to say out loud to my parents, because I wasn't really sure. And I remember just kind of throwing it out there to her of like, well, what if I could do this, or how could I do this? And she just would always tell me that, you know, she wanted me to really feel like I was doing something that was tied to my purpose and not just going about my day. And that, you know, her and my parents and so many people that came before my family had worked hard for me to be able to have a choice. And I mean, I couldn't have been more than 7 or 8 at this time. And so I just remember thinking, not feeling like a responsibility, but just feeling like I have something here and I want to carry it in the right way. And so I've just been cognizant of that, and that feeling of there's just something in burning in me, and it's not anyone else. It's just running through my veins. And so when I've had that feeling in my heart, I'm like, oh, but you can stay, you can do this, you can do that. But I always feel it.
Well, I need to ask you a whole bunch of questions about the job that feeling led you to, in addition to the email from David about editing the cut. And the first one is, the last couple of months, I feel like the cut has just been on this preposterous run of viral essays and articles. There was Emily Gould on marriage, the one about the financial columnist getting scammed.
Charlotte.
There was the one recently about marrying an older man. Twitter is like, it's not a great place, in my opinion, at the moment. And it seems like the cut is finding ways to, like, I don't know whether it's go back in time. There's something that feels kind of nostalgic about it, but also feels like maybe no one else is doing it. How are you tapping into that energy on the internet, which seems in such short supply to me at the moment?
I think it's a lot of things at once. We joke a lot that it feels like whack-a-mole, like there's one thing and then another thing just comes up. But what comes to mind is, you know, A, I do think that, you know, we didn't invent op-eds. And so a lot of it, when people are right now specifically saying, you know, there's so many viral essays on the cut, we've been doing this for a really long time, right? And so, but specifically in this format, probably around this time last year was when we started to do theme weeks. And it was just something that I remember talking to David about, in a sense of, obviously some of my references are coming from childhood. And one of them that I think about often is when I used to want to play double Dutch. And this was a huge feat as a young Black girl to be able to play double Dutch and timing it right and getting in the ropes right. And it often felt like there's this news cycle that may be going left. Our competitors may be going right. How do we jump in the middle at the right time and create our own narrative and conversation? And so we just started doing theme weeks last year because I felt like, yes, we're going to cover things that are happening in the news day to day that we have to cover and that we want to have something to say about. And I'm aware of what our competitors do, but I don't really want to do that. And I want to do what we're really invested in. And so that was really my thinking and trying to start some of that. And we did some of that last year with, we did a divorce week. We did a flirting week. We did a lot of different ones just to kind of say, like, this is something that we feel like is in the air. And this is just a conversation that we want to have in the middle. And so a lot of these essays now people are reading. And, you know, the age gap one was part of a theme week that we just did around women and money and the conversations that you're having about how expensive life is right now, right? So I think a lot of it has felt like people are just catching up to that, but it has been part of a larger strategy for us to kind of be in the middle and have our own conversations with the reader.
I love that idea of hopping in. What does that do for the cut?
I think that people are very fascinated with the virality, but for me, it's more so all of this is legacy making work. And we don't have, the cut hasn't been around nearly as long as a lot of the other established publications, right? And so I'm not, you know, thinking about the popularity of it or if we get certain likes. I'm not even on Twitter. So people send me the tweets. I decided to disengage a long time ago, but it's more so about the influence and impact. And I think that that's changed what we're trying to do and where we've been trying to go. And specifically with the personal essays, it is more so, I think when you read them on the cut, there's just a level of vulnerability that you read, but then there's also just a level of discernment in the assigning of what is actually something worth a deep dive on. But I also would shout out Jen Ortiz, who's our deputy editor, Marissa Carroll, our executive editor, because they're just incredible and such a big part of everything that we do at the cut, but they don't shy away from the really hard stories. And so I do think that when you read a lot of the op-eds on other sites, it is just the surface level take, whereas I feel we're much more skeptical, but not judgmental. We want to dig a little deeper. And so I do think that's also part of what people are taking note of.
It's a lot of phrases in there that I feel like are going to stick with me: skeptical, not judgmental, and the idea of legacy building, that these stories are helping to build a brand, even if a lot of it is kind of like drive-by traffic, that some of the folks are going to keep developing a relationship with what the cut means.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want it to be transactional. I think so much of the cut is about community. So I don't want it to just be, you click on this, you read this, that's it. Even when we publish those essays, so much of it is me thinking, okay, we're publishing this, but then what are the next three things that you're going to want to read based off of you reading this? And we swarm a lot of topics or just things that we really care about. But that community aspect is really important to me in these essays and the work that we're doing at large, because a lot of it comes from a place of what I honestly think is, what are you too scared to talk to your friends about? What do you hide from your therapist?
Yeah.
Or what do you tell your therapist that you're like, I'm never going to tell anybody? What are the things that you Google that you're like, I would never let anybody see that? And honestly, those kinds of pieces do really well because people want to feel like they're not the only one who's thinking about this.
That's a pretty good place to hop in. People's secret Google searches and
the
stuff that they won't tell their friends. Can I go back to something you just said for a second?
Mm-hmm.
How does not being on Twitter impact you in your work? Like, does that make you better at your job, or just like feel better in your mind, which makes you better at your job?
I think feel better in my mind, but it just was a personal choice, because I feel like part of media sometimes makes people feel like they have to have a well-formed, thought-out opinion about everything. And there's this pressure that you have to say something about every single thing that happens. And sometimes I'm just not ready. Sometimes I just don't feel like I have an opinion yet. Sometimes I want to do more research, and I don't want everything to be so reactionary. And so I just decided a long time ago to disengage. But I am on Instagram, and I do make an effort to not be an ivory tower. Like, the door is open with me. People DM me randomly all the time, and I have never met them, and we'll send them a message back. And I really am invested in our community at The Cut. I look at our comments. At night, what I do is I watch TikToks of people doing takes on Cut stories and what they think about it. And I want to hear what they're mad about, or what they don't like, or what they want us to do more of, or why they think we shouldn't have given that person the platform. All of it matters to me. And I do specifically think with The Cut, it's such a joy to see people write 3 paragraphs in a comment section, because that's not really something that you see that much anymore. It's usually just keep scrolling. That's nice, whatever. That's kind of predictable. And so I do want to make sure the door is open, and I don't want to take that for granted, because I think it's a really rare feeling.
I feel like what you're talking about a little bit is what the role of a magazine is in 2024. Having its own conversation, developing its own community. Is there another way that you think about what a magazine is in 2024 and what the role of a magazine is in 2024?
I just think about when I started this role, particularly, I just remember doing so much research about all of our competitors, all the different magazines, and feeling like that, especially because, you know, one of our verticals is style, that it just felt like the way that the industry always talked about any women's magazine that wanted to talk about style remotely was always, you're just fashion and you're siloed in this way, right? And it felt like then you can't talk about all these other things. You can't care about the world. You can't write about abortion or politics or the election. And I just didn't want The Cut to be siloed. And so much of the work that we do is, what does a modern women's fashion magazine look like, and redefining that for people. And I realized very early on that, like, creating that new frame of reference for people so that they, because I don't think they really understood where we were trying to go, would take a lot more work to give them those building blocks of, this is what it's going to look like, because you haven't been presented with this idea before. And so I think in tone, it really was important to me for us to not be so aspirational. We can talk about luxury items. We can talk about fashion that's really expensive or beautiful, all of that. But we don't want to make people feel bad, like they can't be part of this, or that they, or if they can't afford this, that this isn't for them. And then we don't want it to also be too passive. On the other end, a lot of the other fashion magazines, I think in my mind, felt like maybe you pick it up or maybe you don't, or it just feels like you just get one experience that is straight, just shopping. And yes, shopping can be fun, but that's not the totality of your life or your identity. And it just felt too casual in their relationship with readers. And so we always talk about, how do we create a relationship with people that's more approachable? Mm-hmm. We talk so much about, how do we make this feel like your group chat? It's the thing that you're talking to your friends about. And I think that to me is what we always want to strive for, is when we're talking about what we want this magazine to be.
I saw a slogan for the magazine somewhere that was like, style, self, culture, power.
Yeah, those are our verticals.
What's your relationship to power like?
My personal relationship?
Yeah.
I don't think about it too much. I think that I'm aware that there is power in this role, and I'm also aware of how I use it and wanting to use it really responsibly. I think about it just also in a way of just understanding that I want to be a ladder for other young people of color, and I want to be able to help, but also that I still feel like there really is no blueprint for what I want to do. And so I don't feel nearly as resolved or confident or assured in power as most people, I would say.
What do you like as a boss?
Honest answer, I like my team. I do. They're Cut Girls are great. I got to give it to them. I think that they're just fantastic people inside and out. But I also think that we really push each other to be better, but to also have a life. And that was really important to me of, you know, I love this work, love this brand, but also want people to be able to spend time with their families and it not feel so life or death. And I think fashion, I used to have a boss who would walk around and say flames, which is definitely not HR approved, when something was going on. It always felt like something was urgent. It always felt like something was wrong. There was no possible solution. And I'm really proud that this is like such a solutions oriented team, but it always feels like there's a way for us to figure out the next move and to work together as a team. And I like that it's a very calm place.
Do you like managing people?
I do. But I think they're also, we have like very similar, I think, goals and why we all wanted to come back to the Cut or come to the Cut. So I think that there's a lot of alignment in, oh, like I've worked here and I always really want to make this kind of work. So it just feels like we're all able to connect on that level for sure.
And do you feel like part of your job is putting people in the right spots to be successful?
That, but also just giving people the opportunity to make the kind of work they've always dreamed about as well. Like I got that opportunity. I think about that so much with David because coming back, I felt like this role has such responsibility. I take it really seriously, but it didn't feel daunting because David was such a huge support and really no matter the idea or the problem, it felt like there's always a solve here. And I think he's also just facilitated an environment where I felt like we have this garden to grow. Like we have a huge opportunity here. And that environment has just allowed, I think, the Cut to be sharper and funnier than it ever has been.
You talk about it in such a healthy way. What's hard about the job?
It's incredibly time consuming. It's and the news cycle never ends. There's always an idea. I always have other ideas. I wish my brain could turn them off sometimes, but everything is a story, right? So I was sitting at the park the other day and I heard a woman come in front of me. I was reading and I heard her say, oh, I've pitched the Cut, this essay. And I looked up. I also had a tote bag with me that's our Cut tote bag. So I looked up and I was like, did she look at me? Or I didn't know if she was saying it on purpose or she was just saying it casually. She wasn't looking at me, but I looked up and I was hearing her talk about the essay. And then you know, she went on with her dog and her friend talking about it. And I wrote down some ideas. And I think that can be the hard thing because it feels like even in that moment where I'm just trying to read my book and mind my business, there's a story idea.
Mm-hmm. It's just there for you all the time.
Yeah.
Do you sort of like think in magazines?
I don't think so. I think that I'm used to the process now and just how, you know, meticulous you have to be in making a magazine and our site and how many times a day we want to change the homepage or making sure we update this or SEO. Like, I think you think of all these specific rituals that we have to do now, but I don't think the way that my brain works, no.
What about covers? You got like probably 20 covers hanging behind you as we talk. What's the meaning and value of a magazine cover in 2024?
I just see it as something that, you know, we want to consistently say there are certain things that we care about. And celebrity wrangle, I think, is one part of this that is very fickle nowadays and not that much fun. But I'm constantly thinking about the moments that we can have with a celebrity that aren't calculated. And it's not tied to just because you're coming out with something or just because your PR person is the most popular person. And so I just really don't want the Cut to be prescriptive in that way. And I remember like the cover right above me is America Ferrera, who I love and adore. And I remember watching Barbie and thinking everybody's going to put Margot on a cover, but I'm going to put America on a cover. And I think it's consistently been, yes, we zig when they zag, but also I like surprising people. And I also am just interested in the actual story. I think the images are 100% so important in creating elevated fashion imagery, all of that. But also, where is the substance in this? And mm-hmm. So they're important to me and they're important, you know, for the brand, but it's also the storytelling is still number one.
It seems also to me like there's a form of storytelling in the pairings. I mean, you're picking America Ferrera to be on the cover, but also picking who is going to shoot her and how she will be styled. And then I noticed going back through the archives of The Cut and also Teen Vogue, there seems like there's a move that you return to fairly often where you pair a celebrity interview with a interviewer who's not on staff. I mean, somebody else prominent. And there's a story just in those combinations too, like in the choices that you're making.
I think it's just out of the fact that I don't want to do the predictable thing. And I think that, yes, in the choice of who is on the cover, but I think it is also anytime we start thinking about cover specifically, but just overall cut, how do we be intentional and thoughtful in every single move? And so, yes, there's always the big name photographers that people work with, but does that make sense for this story? Who actually would understand this subject through the lens of their point of view, and why this person, and not just because they're a big name, or not just because they're on contract, and not just because people recognize who this person is, but what do they actually have to say as the photographer, as the stylist, as the interviewer? And so to me, it's just more so, I mean, it's been, it makes it harder. I'm not saying that it makes it easier. 100% it makes it harder, but I think it makes it more interesting and thought provoking.
Is the job more interesting to you now? Is it getting more interesting?
Yeah. I mean, there's always a story. I think that's the thing, but I think the hunger for that is in me. And so I always feel like there's another story. There's another thing that I want to do. It's more so of, I think in starting this job, I felt like we were building the ship same time rowing. And it just felt like everything we tried to build, it just was so hard. Like to start a column just felt like, okay, so how do we do this in a way that doesn't make it too precious, and we just want to try this, and this is somebody new and they haven't had a column before? Like all of those little things just felt, I think, so hard to do in conjunction with just a day to day. Whereas now I feel like we have just the foundation of The Cut, but it also feels really expansive when we're coming up with ideas. So it doesn't feel like the ambitious vision is so far from what we're capable of doing.
You can keep pushing it and you know that you can do it.
Yeah.
It's funny that you talk about the way you were thinking about it when you first started, because I read your sort of introductory note as editor-in-chief. And
I haven't read that in so long.
You said that you felt like you only had one shot in the job.
I still feel that way.
What does that mean?
I think people want to believe that we've come so far and progressed so much in culture. But the reality is, like, you know, I'm 33. I'm a Black woman. I work hard, but I don't think that that puts me in a place where I'm just safe to mess up and just to completely do things that are irresponsible. Or I don't think that that puts me in a place where even on our best day that I would be okay to just flail. And I don't think it's not a personal thing. It's not like like someone in particular. It really is just more so, I don't think the industry has progressed as much as people want to say, but also in culture, I think you see so many incredible people make one mistake and lose their job, or they, you know, speak out about something and then the next day something blows up, right? And so I do think that I often feel like I have to be so careful. And that's hard to do because I'm just naturally curious and I want to know and I want to find and explore and do the things. But I do, I'm aware that I'm younger than a lot of other people. I'm aware that people think I'm too young, I'm too Black. I'm aware of all those things and I'm still going to try.
Lindsay, thank you so much for doing this.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor this week was Gabriella Saldivia. Thanks to her. Thanks to Susan Peterson, who handled the show notes. And thanks so much to Lindsay Peoples. She's the editor-in-chief of The Cut. We'll see you next week.
Support for Long Form this week came from Listening. Listening makes it easy to convert written text to pleasant audio tracks that you can take in no matter what you're doing. It offers AI voices that manage to express emotion and correctly pronounce complicated technical terms, all while sounding like actual human beings, not robots. The Listening app might just transform how you consume reading material, and you can give it a shot for yourself risk-free. Normally, you'd get a 2-week free trial, but listeners of Longform get a whole month free. Go to listening.com/longform or use code LONGFORM at checkout. Listening. Your life just got a lot easier.